It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Randy throws the first inning, and he throws like maybe 10 or 11 pitches. Well, Kevin Brown was scheduled to throw the second inning. Kevin Brown is not even close, like nowhere close to being loose. He doesn't even have the catcher down yet. He's just still playing catch, and he's like panicking. Mazzoni calls down to the bullpen. He's like, hey, see if Graves can get ready to go out in the second inning. And Grant, we're already hitting in the bottom of the first.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's From Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today, I'm talking to former All-Star closer Danny Graves, who you can hear calling ACC baseball for ESPN during college baseball season. I had a great time walking through Danny's career, pitching in big games at Miami in the early 90s, flying through the minor leagues, and eventually settling in as an All-Star closer for the Reds. There's a lot of fun stuff in this one, as Danny talks everything from his favorite Miami football team to what it's like to be teammates with Ken Griffey Jr. and how you'd pitch to prime Albert Pujols, as well as the ever-important question of how do you cultivate an identity for yourself in your post-playing days. Had a great time talking to Danny. Think there's something for everyone in this one. A lot of remember some guys stuff, which regular listeners of the show know I like. So hope everyone enjoys it and really appreciate Danny taking the time. Episodes of Phenom to the Farm drop every other month. If you enjoyed this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast and go check out past interviews. We've got over 100 episodes of Evergreen listening for your pleasure. And if you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA Podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. We've got year-end reviews, minor league all-stars, prospect of the year coverage, and AFL stuff is coming soon. So it is always a good time to be subscribed to Baseball America. And with that, let's talk to Danny Graves. All right, joining in for today's episode from Phenom on the Farm is a fourth-round pick of Cleveland out of Miami in the 94 draft, former big league all-star closer Danny Graves. Danny, thanks so much for joining the show.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. Finally, I'm able to get on. I know we've been trying to do this for a while, so I'm excited about this. Get to talk some baseball again.
Me too. Yeah, no, I've been looking forward to this, and we got linked up through a mutual friend, I guess your co-host. Tell me about what you and Darren do at ACC Baseball, et cetera.
So it's funny, you know, we've been doing this, I think this is our third year that we just completed. And I'd met Darren a few years back at the ACC tournament in North Carolina. I can't remember if it was Charlotte or Durham. They switched back and forth. So we met briefly, and then I got a message from him and said, hey, are you interested in doing a podcast? And I'm like, I don't get into podcasts. I'll listen to some while I'm driving, or I'll listen to some just, you know, hanging out at home, but like, I'm not like dead set in podcasts. So I'm like, dude, let me think about it. Cause I kind of want to do it, but you know, I'm not sure if I'm ready to commit. So I thought about it. And I'm like, man, I just love to talk. I love baseball. So I said, this is going to be perfect. So I ended up agreeing to do it, and we've gone for 3 years now. And it's great because, Kyle, we don't just talk baseball. Well, so it's ACC baseball, et cetera. So we talk ACC for a lot of the show, but then the et cetera part, we just ramble on and just talk about whatever. Kind of like what we were doing before we started recording right now. Just kind of talking like we're hanging out in a room, you know? And it's been great. Darren's awesome. And yeah, he does all the dirty work behind the scenes, and I just show up.
Darren's the man. I'm curious, as a guy, like, you obviously you went to Miami. You guys were an independent when you went to Miami. Uh-huh. Do you consider yourself like an ACC guy? Like, do you just kind of go wherever Miami goes, or do you like, do you have a conference affiliation in your heart?
So prior to me joining ESPN and ACC Network, I was just Miami. Whatever Miami was doing, I was following them. I wasn't dead set on the ACC conference. But now I'm like die hard. It makes me mad when people don't give ACC conference respect. It's crazy. I'm so loyal to this conference now. And yeah, we were independent when I was playing. But you know, after being around all these teams for quite a few years now, it's been great. I love everything about it.
Do you have a favorite Miami football team? Like, which one brought you the most joy? You've got quite a few to pick from.
My freshman year was 91, 92, and 91 football season won the national championship. And undefeated, Dennis Erickson was the head coach, but the team was stacked. Warren Sapp, Gino Toretta was the Heisman Trophy winner, Lamar Thomas, Forrest Copeland, wide receivers. And the defense was absolutely ridiculous. Like, Warren Sapp came in. Well, Dwayne Johnson was on the team too.
Yeah, the Rock.
The Rock, yeah, as a nose tackle. Well, Warren Sapp comes in as a tight end, gets recruited as a tight end because the athleticism that he has is ridiculous. You would never know it just by looking at him. So they move him to nose tackle, and he takes over most of the playing time. And it's just like, this team was unbeatable, man. Like, nobody could do anything to get close to this team. That was so much fun watching. And I remember 22-0 against Nebraska, the national championship.
I promise we'll get to baseball at some point, but I've watched the U documentaries a bunch, mm-hmm. but like going to games at the old Orange Bowl with those teams, like, can you just walk me through that experience?
Well, a lot of them I don't remember because
it was college.
Yeah. And you know, I don't know what the rules are nowadays at college campuses, but, we were always told, we're thankful that the games were at the Orange Bowl because games that are on campus, you weren't allowed to have beer. They weren't allowed to sell beer. I don't know how true that was, but that we believed it. So we just loved the fact that we can go to the Orange Bowl. You get on the Metro Rail. There was nobody driving. We got to drink as much as we wanted to and just hang out in the student section and just wreak havoc while our team was just dominating everybody. And a lot of the games we would leave early because back then Miami was just putting beat downs on everybody. But the atmosphere of the Orange Bowl is just unreal, man. Like, it's nothing compared to any other stadium that I've ever been at. It's so loud and it wasn't very clean, but it was very old and nostalgic and just, it was an amazing time. And I can tell you this, anytime we played like Florida A&M, or I don't know if we played Bethune-Cookman, but we would go halftime show just to watch the halftime show of the band, and then we would leave because we knew it wouldn't be a good football game, but we wanted to see the band.
Wanted to see the band. Yeah, it's like the saddest part in that documentary when they tear down the Orange Bowl. I think they end the first one with that.
Yeah.
Of the tearing it down, which is a bummer. But let's talk about you. Let's talk about baseball. So you grew up in a baseball hotbed, like playing in Florida, but it's pre-perfect game, pre-travel ball. Like, how much baseball did you play year round?
I tell people all the time that we didn't have any of that stuff. So we played Little League. And then when Little League was over, we would play, they called it Winter League at the time, but it was like a month long thing where you just kind of new kids that are aging up, kind of get a chance to play with some other kids and just kind of get baseball back into the blood. And then all of a sudden when that was over, and that's usually over around Thanksgiving, then we wouldn't start again until like February or March. And it was like, there was not baseball 24/7, you know, every single day of the year like there is now. But I loved that because we got to grow up and be kids. We got to do other things. If we wanted to play other sports, we could. But like the baseball, once you got into it, once it started, it was serious. Like, there was no messing around because of the hotbed that it was, the competition, the players that from that area were very advanced, you know? So you had to be ready. You had to be on your game. By the time we got into high school, if you weren't ready to play, you're going to get left behind because there wasn't, you know, the travel ball and the all these showcases and stuff. So, I mean, you had to figure out how you're going to be ready for the season.
Yeah, you famously faced Bert Kreischer in high school, which was just one of my favorite YouTube clips ever of that interview. But anyone else in the area that popped, like who was the dude? Like, you ended up being a dude, but who were the dudes in the area?
So Carl Everett played against him in high school, and he was a pitcher.
That's a scary man.
Yeah.
It's an intense, intense person, seems like.
Very, very intense. But if you know Carl, he's the coolest little dude. Like, he'll do anything for you if you're his teammate. But yes, he could be very mean and scary to some people. But he was a pitcher. He pitched against us quite a bit. He went to Hillsboro High, and that back then was the hotbed. Hillsboro High that produced Sheffield and Dwight Gooden and Vance Lovelace. So against me, Brad Radke was a teammate of Kreischer.
Dude, I'm a Twins fan. Brad Radke is like my first favorite player.
Really?
Love Brad Radke. Oh yeah. Love Brad Radke.
So me and him were the same age. So we were both seniors, and we were the two pitchers that everybody was talking about our senior year.
You and Brad Radke were on the same high school team?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. He went to Jesuit, which was a private school. So we didn't get to play them during the regular season. I went to Brandon High, which was a public school. So we only got to play them if we played them in fall ball or something. So, but me and him were the talk of the town. And I think it was District 13 or something, whatever our district was, the Tampa area, me and him were the pitchers that everybody was talking about, you know, either getting drafted or going somewhere to play in college. And we both got recruited by University of South Florida. He signed to go to USF, but obviously got drafted, I think, seventh round, and he took the money and he went and started playing. I didn't get drafted, and I went to Miami. So we kind of went different routes, but us two, man, we were the flamethrowers. And when I say flamethrowers, Kyle, it was like 91, 92 miles an hour.
That's, I mean, that's gas back then.
Back then, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious about your recruitment. There was an article I read, one in 247 Sports, where my volunteer coach said, I've been asked who's the biggest diamond in the rough you've ever been a part of, hands down. And it was Danny Graves. Like, talk to me about how you wound up going to Miami, and what made you go from a diamond in the rough to like a mainstay on that team as a freshman.
So it was kind of an accident that I ended up going there. You know, I was getting letters my senior year during the fall, you know, little schools, Division II schools, some junior colleges around the area had some interest in me going to school there. And so we had this fall ball at the end of the fall season. There was like an all-star game where they picked a few guys from each school just to kind of go out and show what they had for the scouts. That was like our showcase, one and only showcase that we would have. And I told somebody, if I get picked for this, I'm just going to throw it as hard as I can. I don't care where it goes. I'm just going to grip it and rip it and see what happens. Well, I topped out at 91 that night, and I ended up pitching good. I threw strikes throwing 91. And then the next day, let me go back. So we had a center fielder on our team, Bruce Thompson. He was the number one rated outfielder in the state of Florida. And everybody, all this pro scouts, college scouts, they came to see him. Like, he was the man as far as position players our senior year. So he was on my team at Brandon, but he was in this showcase. So they came to see him. And so I ended up pitching in front of all these scouts, kind of accidentally throwing as hard as I can. And then the next day, Miami reached out to me and said, hey, we want to bring you in and give you a full ride to Miami. And I'm like, what? Like, a full ride? And I didn't know what that was. I just knew that my parents wouldn't have to pay a lot of money to go to school. So I ended up going down there for a visit. Me and Dimitri Young go on the visit together.
The meat hook,
yeah. And
future teammate, right?
Yeah, future teammate, yep, for a long time. And then as soon as that recruiting trip was over, I'm like, I'm signing. I'm not talking to anybody else. I'm not going anywhere else. So I signed early in like November, the early signing date.
How aware, like, you get on campus, and again, before Perfect Game, before social media, before all the rankings or whatever, there's no blogs ranking the Miami recruiting class or anything like that. Like, does that help coming in and not being intimidated? Like, you're all just freshmen, or were you aware, like, oh, there's certain dudes, or I got to beat out this freshman for a spot in the bullpen or things like that? Like, how did that shake out back in the 90s?
So when I was getting recruited there, I didn't really know what to look for, what to ask for. I didn't know how many returning pitchers there were, any of that stuff. I didn't know who was freshman, who was seniors, nothing. I just knew that Charles Johnson was at this school.
Was going to ask about throwing to Charles Johnson.
Yeah. So, yeah, we could get to that for sure. So that's all I knew. Like, Charles Johnson was on this team. And then, of course, they wowed me at the recruiting trip. And then I'm like, okay, I get to play with Charles Johnson. So first day on campus going to practice, there's like 17 pitchers, Kyle. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, what did I get myself into? And I – not that I had any lack of confidence, but I'm like, the odds of a little freshman, and I looked like I was about 12, and I was a little bit.
I can relate. Yeah. I can relate.
Yeah. And I was a little chubby, and I'm like, I can't believe that I just signed to go here and all these pitchers here. Well, they treated me like a high recruit, like I was, and they threw me out in certain situations during the fall. And it turned out, well, okay, well, we don't want you to be a starter. We want to put you in the bullpen. You can handle that, right? And I'm thinking, well, what's my other options? It's either pitch in the bullpen or get redshirted or leave. So I'm like, yes, I can handle that. And it turned out to be the best decision ever, like put me in the bullpen. And just things kind of took off from there. But, you know, it turned out, obviously, the way that Miami recruited, and probably a lot of other colleges at the time too, maybe they still do, but just bringing a plethora of arms, and not everybody is going to stay, you know? Turtle Thomas, our recruiting coordinator back then, was infamous for doing that. Like, just bringing in a lot of arms and seeing what sticks. And thankfully I stuck and ended up having some good years down there.
Yeah, and like as an aside, now with the increased scholarships, I think for like the fully funded programs, that'll be the move of, you know, you can bring a bunch of kids in on a full ride and just see who, instead of, you know, having to portion out the 11.7 and be like, okay, well, these four guys need to work. Now it can be a little more like, yeah, come in. It's like the OK Corral. Whoever comes out of that are your guys.
That's a great analogy. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't imagine trying to split up 11.7 scholarships to a lot of good arms, you know, especially now that I feel like so many more players are not signing to go pro. They're signing and going to college because of the NIL, because of the portal, whatever reasons. I think a lot more guys are committing to colleges these days.
Yeah. Yeah. So on Charles Johnson, like I found when I was in school, I learned as much from the older catchers and the older guys on the staff as I did, you know, my pitching coach. Like, what did you pick up thrown to a guy like that? It was lauded as one of the better big league defensive catchers of his time.
Simple. He's just like, hey, you can throw what you want to throw, but they're going to give the signs from the bench, but just throw it to me. Just throw it. I'll get it. And like, seriously, as simple as that, that's all he had to do. He was so laid back. He was so confident in his abilities, but humbly confident, but he would make you feel confident just like he is. Like, I mean, he would call me Big Dog, but his nickname was Big Dog, but he would call me Big Dog, like kind of like to pump me up a little bit and, you know, make me feel like I belonged on the team. And it was just amazing. Just throw it here. I don't care if it bounces, just throw it. Bring it to me.
You stepped in as a freshman. You're a major part of the bullpen on that 92 team. And just like looking back at what the college baseball postseason was, especially you guys, you're not in a conference, so there's no conference tournaments, anything like that. It's that six team regional and then the College World Series. Like the postseason seemed incredibly, incredibly rapid, like gone in a flash. Whereas now you've got, it's essentially if you're in a conference, which is pretty much everyone, is a 4-week affair versus like you've got to get out of the 16 regional and then you've got, you know, and then you've got Omaha. Like did it seem as quick as it looks on paper?
Yeah, it was essentially one weekend. Regionals was one weekend where you possibly are playing doubleheaders. You're going to play you start on the Friday, I believe it was, and then if you end up losing, have to come out of the loser's bracket, you're going to have to play some doubleheaders and possibly have your number one guy throw Friday and Sunday, which that year we did, Jeff Alkire was our number one guy. He ends up throwing Friday. I think it was Notre Dame who beat us one of the games. So we had to play them again. And then we had to play on the last day to get to the World Series. And he had to pitch again because we ran out of arms to start. So, and it's all just like that. Like there was no, okay, let's mix and match, try to figure out who's going to do this, who's going to do this when. And like, it's, you got to figure it out now. And yes, it was quick, but at the same time, like I liked that setup because that really, you know, you really got to figure it out. If you're good enough to go, you got to figure it out. Now with the regionals and then the super regionals, man, I feel like if your regionals are really good, let's say North Carolina, for example, right? This past year, they dominated through the whole season. Regionals, they dominated. Then they get to super regionals and just they're not the same. But if there was one long regional like there used to be, then, you know, maybe they're in. People are going to say they like the super regionals better. I don't mind either way. I just know when I played, I loved the fact that it was like one weekend. One long weekend could be five or six games. You got to figure it out or else you're going home.
Yeah. The length always helps the deeper, better teams for the most part, because like with the LSU Little Rock regional this year, by the time they get to game five, well, LSU's got better options in game five than Arkansas Little Rock is going to have in game five.
Exactly.
Especially now with how you're talking about the workload thing, like, it happens a little bit, but we're not often throwing the Friday night guy on Sunday or the Friday night guy on Monday and things like that. But I was curious, like, the workload of a college closer back then, was it like every game you've got to be ready? Like, even if you threw a 2-inning, 3-inning save on Friday, is it like, hey, Saturday you might be up to?
Yes, that's how I wanted it, you know, and that really didn't come till my junior year. When Jim Morris it was his first year on campus with us. And he just kind of said, hey, if you want the ball, I'm going to give you the ball and we'll run. We'll run with it from there. And I felt like me and Jay Tesmer pitched every single game. I know we didn't, but it felt like that. And we were pitching.
You had almost as many innings as games in the season, which as a reliever that's a lot.
Yeah. And I've thrived on that. And, you know, calling games and watching games for ACC now, ACC Network now, all the weekday games that they have, like the non-conference games and the they say the weaker games, but I don't believe they're weaker because they're still playing SEC teams, you know, during the week these days. But we were ready to pitch no matter what. And I felt like we had weekday games and then a weekend series a lot of times. So Tesmer and I, we would be ready even during the weekday games. And I know a lot of times now they don't do that with their stud arms. It's kind of like throwing out the arms that could help them later on, get them some experience or whatever. We wanted to win every game and we were ready to pitch every single game. And you know, whatever, I don't know how many games and innings that you mentioned that I threw, but I felt like me and him were in every day. There was some games that starters would go 5 innings on a Friday. Tesmer would throw 2 and I would throw the last 2. And then Sunday, same thing. He would throw 6 and 7. I'd throw 8 and 9. And we both loved it. And he did that the following year when I left with another reliever that came in. So it kind of groomed us and got us ready for pro ball, I felt like.
Yeah, your junior year, you threw 61 innings of what I believe was 65 games all the way through the College World Series with a 0.89 ERA and 21 saves, which is pretty good, you could say. Pretty decent year. But I had Coach Morris on the show a couple of years ago. I think by the end of the episode, I was ready to run through a brick wall for that guy. I can see why he had so much success. Do you have a good Coach Morris story for me?
One I can tell you, and I'm sure he would remember this, but when we lost in Omaha my junior year, so I tore my ACL the first game of that College World Series, and we ended up going 1-2. So we lost first game, won second game, and then lost the third game. So we're flying home, and now remember the year before we had Brad Kelly as our head coach, and there was some trouble at the airport where he apparently bought some players, some alcohol or whatever. That was kind of one of the stories. So we're on the back of the plane, me and a couple other juniors, were drinking some beers. Like, we got some beers from the flight attendants, and they let us have them.
And you're still presumably leaving. You've been drafted. So, like, you're, all intents and purposes, you're gone.
Yeah. So, yeah, there was four of us, in the back that were drinking, and we were all roommates, me, Bruce Thompson, Mike Metcalf, Kenny Henderson. We were roommates, and we all got drafted in the top 10 rounds, all four of us. So we're back there just drinking and talking about the season or whatever. And three comes back and he's like, I can't believe you guys are doing this because of what happened the year before. He goes, but I guess you guys have already decided you're leaving anyway, so it doesn't matter. Then he just walked off and like, it was no big deal. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I just made him mad. And that being his first year, he never got mad at anybody. Like, he just kind of let us do whatever we wanted to do. And I'm like, I felt so guilty that I just got Coach Morris mad at us. So we stopped drinking on the plane from then on, but he was such a good dude, man. He knew how to transition into Miami's program after leaving Georgia Tech, and they were number one in the country when he left. Do you remember that team, Kyle? Mm-hmm.
It was like Jay Payton, Veritek, Nomar, right?
Yeah. And Brad Rigby was one of the pitchers. He was a second round draft pick. So yeah, they were stacked. Number one team in the country. He leaves, comes to us, and we're like, what do we expect from this guy? Like, what's he going to do? Is he going to come in here and try to change things around? And he basically said, be on time, work hard, and call me three. He said the rest was like, you guys just play. And he pretty much just let us play. And it was great.
I got the vibe that he was a player's coach. Seemed very much the type, instead of like not the drill sergeant type, like very much the you guys do you.
Yes. And that was awesome. That was awesome for, you know, him coming in. We had a lot of juniors and some seniors that weren't going to be there, that getting drafted or graduating. And he just kind of, you know, took a step back and was like, you know, this is y'all's team. I'm just here to lead you. And never got upset, like I said, until, I don't even think he was upset on the plane when we were drinking. He just was like a little disappointed, which makes you feel even worse. But
yeah, like, I'm not mad, I'm disappointed is one of the toughest things you can get.
Totally, totally. But he was great, man. Like, if he ever did get upset or not happy, you knew it, and you tried to fix it right away.
So that plane ride home, so you get drafted, by Cleveland, but then, like you said, you tear your ACL. Mm-hmm. What's going through your mind? Because that's, I mean, we look at ACLs now kind of like a UCL of like, oh, you know, be back in a year, we're cool, you know, but yeah. Early 90s, a little bit different. Like, what was going through your head? And I'm certain you're talking to an advisor, you're talking to someone, like, did you think, I might have to come back, like, I might not get signed?
The first thing I thought was, well, there goes all the money for the fourth round. And, you know, fourth round money back then. So I signed for 80 in the fourth round, and I don't know what the average was, but, you know, I wanted something around 100 with, you know, with school included. And it ended up, they gave me 80 plus 20 for school. So I got the 100 that I was looking for. But at the time I was thinking, man, I might have to go back to school. And if I go back to school, I have no leverage, because when you were a senior back then, you had zero leverage.
You're getting $1,000 maybe.
If that. Yeah. Yeah. And I was scared to death. I'm like, I didn't even think, am I ever going to play again? Is my knee going to be good? Am I going to be healthy? Never thought that. I just thought I might have to go to school again and just play for nothing. So by the time I got back to the hotel, the day that I tore my ACL, because it was a Thursday I got drafted, Saturdays I tore my ACL. By the time I got back to the hotel after seeing doctors and stuff, I had messages waiting for me from the Cleveland staff saying, don't even worry about this. We know that you can recover. We know ACL is not a big deal. We still want to sign you. And I'm like, oh, this is amazing. But then I start thinking, well, am I going to get shortchanged? Well, we ended up, after the season is finally over, they said, you know, let's fly you up to Cleveland. We'll We'll have our doctors look at you and give you a diagnosis and see when we can have surgery or whatever it is that you're going to do. They ended up like saying, give me that offer. And me and my parents thought that was a very fair offer. And that was a lot of money. Like, we'd never seen that kind of money before, never heard of that kind of money, you know, coming our way. So I'm like, where do I sign? Like, give me the papers. And the best part about it, Kyle, I know this is very selfish of me, but I got to miss short season. I didn't have to go to Watertown.
So I was going to, like, typically, you know, if you had gotten drafted, you hadn't torn your ACL, you're probably spending the rest of the summer at short season. Like, what did your first year of being a professional look like? Like, did they send you to Arizona or to wherever the complex was at the time? Like, whoa. Because, you know, if you had torn your ACL and you were going back to Miami, I'm sure it would have been stuffing on campus with Miami's doctors or rehabbing. Yeah. Like, what was the process of your, I'm now a professional, but I'm also an injured professional.
Right. So I ended up having a surgery like the second or third week of June. So I stayed in Miami for that summer and took some classes for summer school. Then I ended up staying there during the fall and took more classes and rehabbed the whole time. So by the time the following year came, January, March. So minor league camp was March. You know, I was just continuing to rehab, and I get there. And it was in Winter Haven, Florida. That's where the spring training was. And I was just told I had to wear a brace no matter what kind of physical activity I was doing. I had to wear a brace the whole season, even though I felt great. Wear a brace under my uniform. It was a giant brace too. It was so annoying. But,
and that was back in like the painted on pants era too.
Yeah.
So that's got to be tough to get around the brace.
I have baseball cards that have this brace sticking out of like you can see clearly. It's like, why do you even have pants on? Like, you can see the brace. Like, it was huge. So, you know, they didn't tell me anything once we started spring training. I was just part of the routine, part of everything. And because I was a college guy, they had me slotted at the time to start in high A ball. And then, of course, during the games, I was kept pitching well and kept pitching better and better. So they stuck me there and they said, this is perfect. We'll send you to high A. You don't have any reason to go to our low A team or stay here for extended, because extended spring was one thing I did not want to do. That's miserable.
Yeah.
So
never heard a good word about extended spring.
No. And so I did everything I could to stay healthy, and I got in good shape and I pitched well. Thankfully, I got to leave and when the season started and go to Kinston.
You talked about the workload and college, like how you went about it that junior year, where you're throwing two innings on Friday, two on Sunday. You're the closer on your minor league teams. What's the difference in routine and habits as like a minor league closer versus a college closer?
Well, so the minor league closing, it's one inning. I knew I was going one inning, and I wasn't going to come in the seventh to finish the game, you know, or coming in the eighth. And I wasn't going to have a guy ahead of me throwing sixth and seventh and me throwing eighth and ninth. Like, typically, I mean, I think there were some times, obviously, I came in the eighth with a couple outs and had to get four or five outs to finish the game. But it was generally just the one inning. And I feel like, man, I had like 46 innings in Kinston and maybe 40 something appearances. So it was pretty close to innings to games. So there wasn't a whole lot of multi-inning games. And that was the biggest difference. Not that they didn't take care of me at Miami, but they had money invested. So they're not going to just throw me out there and, you know, and other relievers just to throw multiple innings day in and day out. Mm-hmm. And there were times
even then, like, it seems like you could have been called in at any game. Whereas I feel like now guys are spaced even down the minors, like, spaced out a little more.
Yeah, because agents are involved a little bit more now, I believe. I don't know that for a fact, but that's what I've heard, that, you know, agents are saying that their players shouldn't pitch more than 2 days in a row, or if they have 2 days in a row, they need at least 2 days off. And I'm like, well, how do you get to the big leagues if you're just going to pitch every now and then? You know, that was my thing. When I was in spring training, I got to, even though it was minor league camp, I got to go be a just in case guy in the bullpen sometimes and get to hang out with some of the big league guys. And they would always say, you're not going to make the big league team on the training table. You're not going to make the big league team if you don't pitch, you know, like, so why wouldn't you want to pitch? That's your goal to get to the big leagues, right? You should want to pitch every day. And, you know, I know the injuries are a lot different these days because guys throw a lot harder and they don't really know how to pitch as much. They just throw hard. So they're a little bit more careful. But I always thought the more careful I am, the easier it's going to be for me to get hurt. You know, I know one way to play, and this is it.
You're lights out in Buffalo and AAA to start 96, and then you get the call pretty quick. Like, walk me through the first call up to the big leagues.
So that whole year, 95, my first year, I did get called up rather early in my career, but I feel like it was more of a right place at the right time. I was pitching well, and each level in 95, you know, I go up to AA. Somebody got hurt. They needed an extra arm. I end up throwing like 20 plus innings, didn't give up a run. Well, at that time, somebody in AAA goes down and they're getting ready to go to the playoffs. So they bring me up to the AAA and finish the season there. So then I start the next year in AAA. And kind of just start right where I finished. You know, things were working great and I was getting guys out. And again, right place at the right time. Dennis Martinez, El Presidente,
yeah,
on the big league team. He was obviously in the rotation. Well, he was older at the time. I think he might have been 40 or close to 40. So he was having elbow issues. They decided to put him on the DL. Well, I should say the IL now. It was the DL back then, obviously. So they put him on the IL. Julian Taveras was a reliever. They put him into the rotation and they're like, we need a guy like stat from AAA. So I get called up and I'm like, are you serious? I'm not even on the roster yet. Like, and I didn't even have a year and a half of minor league ball, you know? And I'm like, okay, I'm ready for this. Let's go. So I get called up and right away, Mike Hargrove was the manager. Mark Wiley was the pitching coach. And they both said, be ready at any moment. We don't know what role, just, you know, early, late. The only role we know you're not going to have, you're not going to be a starter and you're not going to be the closer because Jose Mesa was closing at that time and he was lights out. Yeah. So they said, be ready at any moment. So I'm ready. Well, I go 15 days, Kyle, without like sniffing a game.
You were like, up for 15 days?
Yeah.
And didn't pitch.
I warmed up a couple times, but I didn't get in. And do you know Josh Burns? I believe he might be with the Dodgers now. He was a general manager for the Diamondbacks. I don't know, years ago. And well, he was kind of an assistant with Cleveland coming up, working his way up the ranks. And I would see him every day. He's like, when are they going to pitch you? I'm like, I don't know, man, but it's driving me nuts. I need to get in there. I need to pitch. So finally, I get in it to a game in Minnesota. I did collect a paycheck without pitching, though, which was nice.
I'm sure that was nicer than the minor league checks.
Yeah, I cleared like $4,000 in 2 weeks, and I didn't even play. I'm like, I'm so rich. This is great. And so when I finally got in a game, I do remember that I threw a strike. My first pitch was a strike. I ended up giving up a few runs, I think three runs, but I had three strikeouts and we still won the game. It was a blowout game in Minnesota, but I wasn't nervous because I was so mad that it took so long to get me into the game. And I don't know if I'm thankful for that because I've pitched nervous before and it was awful. So it turned in more of a anxious. I cannot wait to get in this game.
Before you got up to the big leagues, like just like it, you hadn't had an ERA over two seemingly ever. College, no. In high school, I couldn't find many of the high school stats, but I'm assuming you kept runs off the board. Like we talked about this a little bit before we started recording, but like the first time, like hitting failure, or at least like hitting this increased level of competition, where it's like almost no one is carrying like a one ERA in the big leagues. Like you're Paul Skeens, handful of relievers.
Right.
So
right.
Like how did you grapple with that? Especially those first two seasons of kind of up and down life and trying to stick where it's like, I'm suddenly not as lights out. It's not like I'm that far off, but I'm not, you know, I'm not shut down like I have been pretty much my entire life.
Yeah. So I never thought I was like a shut down, like dominating pitcher to begin with. And I, even through high school, you know, I was one of the harder throwers. I mentioned me and Brad Radke both threw really hard, but like to me, I never expected to have such good numbers. I knew that I was good, but at the same time, like those numbers are kind of unrealistic. If somebody were told me I was going to go to college in my junior year, I was going to have a 0.89 in a full season, I'd be like, you're nuts. That's impossible. And then going to pro ball, you're going to tell me I'm not going to give up a run in double A or, you know, whatever my ERA was in single A, I'd be like, you're nuts. That's impossible. So I know that all that's those numbers, they look great, but I know they weren't realistic to being a professional baseball player. I just had really good seasons then, good times then. And I knew the lumps were going to come. And thankfully, my dad taught me as a young kid, like failure's like inevitable. Like you're going to fail at just about everything you do. It's just what you do with it afterwards. And my dad was so positive. Like he never got upset or never got mad if I didn't pitch well or didn't play well, or, you know, it was like, okay, son, it's okay. We got another game tomorrow or whatever. Like it was not a big deal to him. So that kind of was like how I was bred, you know, like it's just a game. Yeah. And obviously there was times I was not happy with my performance, but the very next day I forgot about that performance and I couldn't wait to get the ball again.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
The Gentle Dentist continues to hear compliments from their patients.
I am so glad we found the Gentle Dentist. It is truly pain-free. Not just for me, but I'm so happy my children have had such a wonderful experience. They love the Smile Club.
I'm a business owner, so every minute of my time is valuable. I love that they are so respectful of my time.
The Gentle Dentist in Worthington. Call now. New patients receive a free sonic toothbrush with a cleaning and exam. Call 614-431-3311.
What did you, I'm always interested, like if you're playing a baseball video game, if you're playing the show at like 23, then your player progresses the next year and they earn like 6 XP or whatever. And they just start getting slowly better and better and better. And like, if you look at your career, so what happened? You had your first couple seasons and then like you settle in, you just get better and better and better. You turn into an all-star. What are those things, those building blocks that led you from, you know, young reliever, getting hit around some things like that to all-star closer? Like how much of it is how to pitch? How much of it is learning different things to do physically? Like what blocks did you put in place to become kind of the mainstay that you became in Cincinnati?
Well, I'm glad you said that because learning how to pitch was the thing. You know, I always felt like I had good stuff and people always told me I had good stuff and I had good movement on my fastball. I had a really good curveball. But I felt like for so long, I just would get by with stuff, you know, and, you know, when people don't see a lot of you, especially in the minor leagues, your stuff can dominate for a little while. But when you get to the big leagues, your stuff is not going to help you. You need more than just stuff. And I always had mentality. I think, you know, with my dad, the way that he was, my mentality was always there. Like I knew how to deal with the ups and downs and it was just learning how to pitch with my stuff. So I get traded from Cleveland to Cincinnati and end up tearing my labrum. I have surgery and just something clicked after surgery. I really focused on getting in great shape and I focused on how am I going to get my stuff to work both sides of the plate? How am I going to get my sinker to to be able to do the Greg Maddux sinker, you know, inside to a lefty? How am I going to get my curveball to not just be a roll, get me over curveball? I want it to be nasty. Just things like that, you know, and just having confidence in your stuff. I felt like I turned into a pitcher with good stuff for quite some time instead of just a dude that had good stuff. If that makes any sense. I know you, it probably makes sense to you.
What was the process for developing? Because this is pre-Trackman, Rapsodo, whatever, the pre-pitch labs and stuff. So for you, it's like, I'm trying to figure out this Greg Maddux sinker. I'm trying to improve my curveball. Like what, how much goes into that? Like, is it working with the bullpen catcher or something? Or like grip tinkering? Like how, you know, how much work goes into, you know, you say, I have this mission of learning how to backdoor my sinker, like, uh-huh. like front door to lefties. Like how much work goes into that?
So a lot of it's just listening. You know, I had Don Gullett was my pitching coach and Tom Hume was my bullpen coach for all those years in Cincinnati. And this is not a knock on any of the other pitching coaches I had elsewhere, but for some reason, these two guys like knew me like the back of their hand. If I'm trying to go backdoor sinker, you know, or into a lefty, like I would try to throw it and I would just feel like I'm visualizing it getting there. Well, Don Gullett, he told me one thing. He's like, you can see it going there, but where are you starting it? Where are you throwing it at? Like, what's your visualization of where you're going to throw it? And I said, I don't know. He's like, pick a spot. Okay, throw it at his hip. You know it's not going to hit him in the hip. Throw it at his hip and then see what happens. So first one I throw at the lefty's hip, and it comes right back over the plate. He looks at me, and I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. He goes, now get your fingers on top. Like he broke things down, like every little piece, get your fingers on top and not on the side. Cause you get it on the side, it's going to go laterally. And that's where the round ball can hit the round bat if it's lateral. But if you get it to sink just this much, now it's not hitting the solid part of the bat. So get your fingers on top. And I'm like, man, that is amazing. I get my fingers on top and it goes, it's nasty. That turned into being an easy pitch for me. You know, and with my curveball, it's just a matter for me, it was my mechanics. If my mechanics were a little too fast or if I didn't stay back, but both these coaches knew right away how to get me back on track. And then now it's like, okay, I can get myself back on track without getting too far, you know, too deep into trouble. But it's just a matter of listening and learning how to pitch. And I can't imagine what all these, you know, TrackMan, Rapsodo, and all that stuff does for people right now. But I was really good at just trying to pay attention to what the coaches say and trying to visualize what they want me to do.
Mm-hmm. So you harness all that and you settle in Cincy, you get the closer job. But just like looking at the stats, it's not like you're just coming in now to throw the ninth and just the ninth. You're racking up like 80 all the way up to 110 innings in a season as a reliever. So once you're Danny Graves' closer, what is at that time? What did that mean? Because that seemingly doesn't just mean if we're up by three runs or less in the ninth, I'm coming in. Like how was workload managed? How was it conveyed to you what your role is? So you had kind of an idea of these are the situations where I need to be ready to go in.
Yeah. So Jack McKeon was the manager in those days, and
legend.
Yeah, legend, Trader Jack, and. I mean, there was nobody more old school than Jack McKeon. Like if he was a Goose Gossage guy where his closer is going to throw three innings if he needs to. And, you know, it started from spring training, like trying to build us up, trying to get us innings. And I know like these days, spring training, guys don't pitch much in the big league games. They might pitch on the side or throw in a minor league game or whatever. I was throwing every other day in spring training. Like I would have up to, you know, 15 innings in spring training just to be ready for the season. And I loved that. And, you know, maybe because going back to the college days, I enjoyed throwing multiple innings. I enjoyed being out there. But with Jack, you knew if there was certain situations, you're going to come in this game. And we had a really good bullpen for a few years there when Jack was there. And you kind of knew if you were going to go more than one inning, depending on what the other bullpen guys, how they were feeling or how much work they've had in the last couple of days. And like, there'd be times where Don Gully would come up and say, "Hey, might need you in the seventh today, or might need you to go a couple innings." I'm like, "Bring it. I'm ready. I'm ready for it." And, you know, I just felt like I got better and better, especially being a sinker ball guy. Might not have your velocity those back-to-back days of throwing a lot of innings, but my movement seemed to get better. You know, the more that I threw. And I remember in 99, I went four straight games of two innings each game. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
That's a lot.
That was in September. So that was, we were in a pennant race.
You pitched 111 innings that season, yeah, as a reliever, as a closer.
Yeah. Yeah. At 27 saves, 111 innings. And another reliever that we had, I think 115 innings maybe. So the relievers got a lot of work. Our starters, they kind of knew if they didn't have it, they didn't have to go deep in the game because we were picking them up. And I loved multiple innings back then.
You mentioned that pennant race, and before I've had guys on the show with a lot of showtime and asked, like, you watch a game on TV, when the game ends, they'll always show one guy in the losing team's dugout, like, kind of looking real sad. And I'm like, 162 games, how sad is, like, how, you know, whatever, you're going to lose, every team's going to lose 60 games a year minimum, yeah, depending on who you are. Mm-hmm. But 99, you guys won 96 games and didn't make the postseason, which, yeah, I previously had been like, I'm pretty like anti postseason expansion. And now I'm like, if a team wins 96 games, they should be in the postseason. But in, like, I'm sure it's different with a closer, 'cause a lot of times, like, the win or loss, it often in your hand, but like, how demoralizing is a loss in the beginning of August? But I would imagine in a postseason run, like, everything, if you're on a perspective postseason team, everything feels like it carries a certain amount of weight.
Yeah. So that year, 99, when we finished game 162, and 162 was a must win. Like, we going into the last weekend of the series, I think we were up a game or two on the Mets to get the wild card. Well, they end up sweeping, and we start that series 0-2, and like, this is a must win. We have to win to force a game 163. But after, so we ended up winning 162, obviously, but then we're like, dude, if we just would have won one game. So then I'm thinking, well, I blew eight saves that year, so which game can I be blamed for? You know, like, just one of those. If I could have had only seven blown saves, even our first series of the year, we started out 0-3 against the Giants. We got whooped. And it's like, if we could have just been 1-2, not even go, everybody wants to win a series. Well, how about just, we just wanted one of them and then we wouldn't have been in this predicament. So yeah, you kind of go back and you're thinking, especially me, like, which one of those games, like, I hope nobody's blaming that this season on me, which I know they're not, but it's like, I could have blown seven and not eight. We would have been in a different situation, you know?
Yeah. I mean, when I saw 96 wins, I was like, huh, that is, that's an argument for expanded postseason.
Dude, it's totally the best team that never made it, in my opinion. Like,
can you talk to me about the arrival of Griffey? Like, what, if you're a guy who's on the roster, you know, you're like a mainstay in Cincinnati. What, when that news breaks, is that something you call on your teammates being like, oh, or is it just like, oh, okay, we got another guy coming. We got a good player coming.
Well, it happened in spring training. So we were all already there, and there was word that something might be going down to get Griffey. And Griffey Sr. was one of our coaches. He'd been there for a few years already. So I was pretty tight with Griffey Sr. and he wasn't saying anything. And then, so when the announcement's made, we're like, oh my God, 99, we win 96 games, and now we got Ken Griffey Jr. in 2000, buy the World Series tickets. Like, that's exactly what a lot of us thought. Me for sure. I'm like, we're going to the World Series. You know, we got Ken Griffey Jr. We needed another piece, blah, blah, blah. And the excitement was there, but also the pressure was there, especially on me and the bullpen. I don't know how the other guys felt, but if you remember those years, that his last few years in Seattle, their bullpens were terrible and they were losing a lot of games for them. And so it's like, is Griffey coming here because he knows the bullpen's better? You know, we had a great year last year, whatever, all these reasons. And I'm like, we better step it up and get it going, because I don't want to be failing this guy, you know, leaving Seattle and coming here. This is Ken Griffey Jr.
Had you reached a point in your career, though, where, like, you're not starstruck by anyone? Were you ever, like, your rookie year, was there anyone you saw and be like, wow, that's so-and-so who I saw on TV?
I'm so starstruck all the time, Kyle. It's so bad. I fangirl like crazy. It's insane. So I grew up a big, big fan of Ozzie Smith, and, you know, Cardinals fans growing up, and Ozzie was my guy. So word got out that he was my favorite player, and Barry Larkin, who I was in awe of too, because I used to see him in spring training down in Plant City when I lived in Florida. And I would play it off like it's just Barry, no big deal. But this is like Barry Larkin, this is crazy. And so he got word that I was a huge fan of Ozzie. Well, one year in St. Louis, he gets Ozzie to come into the clubhouse. And he's like, Danny, come here. And I'm like, like I was so like embarrassed and starstruck. I didn't know what to do. So I end up going over there. Ozzie signs one of his jerseys for me to Danny, blah, blah, blah. And I don't even know what I said, Kyle. I don't even know what we talked about. I was just in awe. And like still with Griffey, I get starstruck with him. I'll text him every now and then and we'll talk on the phone sometimes. And I'm like, this is Ken Griffey Jr. that I've just been talking to, you know?
That's professional photographer Ken Griffey Jr.
Exactly.
Taking pictures at the Masters.
Yeah, and he's a really good photographer. Well, he better be with that long camera that he has, that long lens. But yeah, I get starstruck like crazy. Even Willie McGee, I grew up
with Cardinals fan.
You know, yeah, Willie McGee was the man too. And a few years back in Chicago, I go to a game and one of my buddies is a bullpen catcher for them. So Willie's walking by. I'm like, oh my gosh, there's Willie McGee. He's like, Willie. He brings Willie over. And I'm like, no, don't do it. So I'm like, hey, Willie, Danny Graves. He's, hey, man, I remember you. I remember facing you. I'm like, you do? It was just the coolest thing that Willie McGee remembered.
So does that go away when you're on the mound, though? No, it's probably different for like the guys you grew up watching versus like the guys who were like your age contemporaries, maybe. Like, say, like you were in the Central, so you know, McGuire and Sosa are like closer to your age per se. Like, they're not like the legends who are still hanging on. But like, is it easier to flush that when it's like, oh, you know, Barry Bonds is up, I gotta face Barry Bonds? Like, is it more like when you're walking, or, you know, when you're at spring training and you see someone or someone like that?
Yeah, it's more just walking around. I think when I was on the mound, I had a different mentality. Even though I didn't look very intimidating, like I felt like I was better than anyone out there. I will say though, in 96, my rookie year with Cleveland, that happened with Cal Ripken Jr. Every time I faced Cal Ripken Jr. And then we traded Eddie Murray that year. He was with us. He actually hit a walk-off home run for my first big league win. We trade him back to Baltimore, and I had to face him then. And I was in awe facing him, but I was his teammate just a couple weeks prior. So, like, but I really feel like that was the only time I had been in awe of facing somebody at the time. Like, and just Ripken was something about Ripken. And I played with his brother, Billy Ripken, in AAA in Buffalo.
And legendary baseball card, Billy Ripken.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I got a bat right back here, a broken bat from Billy that he signed to me, because I used to wear a watch all the time.
How did he sign it? Did he sign the knob?
The knob says Rip.
Okay. Okay.
Here's the knob.
Okay.
So
different than his baseball card knob.
Yeah, it's different than that one. Yeah. So when I got called up to AAA in 95, he was on the team, and I used to wear a watch, and it was kind of like a superstitious thing. So as soon as I would get called to come into game, I'd take my watch off and give it to somebody. I randomly gave it to him my first AAA game. And he's looking at me like, okay. So he signed the bat. Danny, thanks for letting me hold your watch. Billy Ripken.
Yeah, that's a nice pretty little piece sweet. Of memorabilia.
Yeah, yeah. So, but yeah, there's so many stories of all these great players that I played with, man.
And in terms of great players, I want to add the 2000 All-Star game. Like, you make your first All-Star team, and then you're the second guy out. You're following up Randy Johnson in the All-Star game. Like, how does... I presume before the game you knew, like, okay, you're going to be the second guy out. But, like, how did those conversations happen?
Funny you asked that, because I wasn't supposed to be the second guy coming out. Leo Mazzoni had talked to us, all the pitchers, and told us what innings we were going to come in and how they planned it. So I wasn't coming in until the eighth. I wanted to go down to the bullpen, obviously, early to watch all the festivities and kind of hang out with the guys. So Randy throws the first inning, and he throws like maybe 10 or 11 pitches. Well, Kevin Brown was scheduled to throw the second inning. Kevin Brown is not even close, like nowhere close to being loose. He doesn't even have the catcher down yet. He's just still playing catch, and he's like panicking. Well, they called down. Mazzoni calls down to the bullpen. He's like, hey, see if Graves can get ready to go out in the second inning. And Grant, we're already hitting in the bottom of the first. So I'm like, yes, I'm ready. I'm ready right now. I don't care. I'll go in. I did not want to stay for seven innings and just like be anxious and nervous the whole time. So I'm like, yeah, I'm ready. I'll go. I threw a couple pitches in the bullpen and got my eight warm-up pitches on the mound. And I'm like, let's do it. So I just pitched on pure adrenaline. I don't even know if I was loose the whole time. But it ended up working out good because I got to see the rest of the game from the dugout.
Just relax.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's so funny. Like, I wasn't supposed to pitch, but I'm thankful I got to pitch that early.
You've been pretty open about your struggles with mental health during your career, the culture around how that was managed, like back in the 2000s. And it's interesting, like the conversation we've had so far, you seem like someone who genuinely like loved being in the big leagues or just loved baseball and like loved the general experience of it. I know for everyone, like it's a job. It was something like I learned doing this podcast. I always thought like being a pro baseball player would just be the dream job. It's a hard job. If you have a family, if you have kids, like it is a toll on your mental and physical well-being.
Yeah.
But like at what point are you taking your job home with you too much? Are you taking life at home? Like when did things stop being as fun for you?
2003, it started not being fun. Off the field stuff, I was going through a divorce at the time. And, you know, it's really hard to have a family when you're a big league player. People think it's all glory because you make a lot of money. But you have a family because you love your family and you want to be with your family. But when they're not with you all the time, you get a little bit lonely. And as much fun as I had with my teammates and in the locker room and all that, there's still a lot of lonely times. And so you're going through a divorce. And I had three kids with her. And at the same time, I was transitioning from a reliever to a starter.
Which is incredible. I wanted to ask about it. It's crazy that it was the same year, because like adding 70 innings onto your workload as a 29-year-old and something bewildering to say the least. Like an interesting choice.
Yeah, and it wasn't my choice. Like they wanted to do it. I say they. A couple people wanted me to do this years before, like a couple years to give it a shot. And I'm like, why am I not doing good enough at the back end for you? Like, this is, I feel like, you know, I just had a couple years of back-to-back 30 plus save seasons and pitching it, frequently for you. And now you want me to do this. And they're like, well, you have four good pitches that would be great in the starting rotation. So I end up signing a 3-year extension and I'm like, okay, I'll try it now. Well, I mean, it turns out that obviously I was a cheaper way to go to get a starter into the organization, but
because they're paying you good back end reliever money, but not starter money.
Right, right, right. And you know, I felt since I had the security for a couple extra years that I'd give it a shot. And, you know, I would have some good starts, but then I would have one or two bad innings that just blew things out of proportion. Like, you know, I a few times I go 5 or 6 shutout innings, and in that next inning I just give up a 5 spot, and it turned out to be like, well, all that for nothing. Like, this is awful. You know, you have one bad inning, now I got to wait 4 more days to try to pitch again. And even that season, there was times that I was going on 3 days rest. So we went with a 4-man rotation for a couple weeks. So you mentioned the 29-year-old adding extra innings, and now you're throwing every 4th day instead of every 5th day. And I kept trying to battle through it and try to figure it out. But I was not the guy that could throw to a team multiple times in the same game. Like, if you have me face Sosa and Moises Alou Friday, I'll face them again Saturday and have success, and maybe again Sunday and have success. But if I got to face them 3 times in the same day, that second and third time, my stuff is not going to be as good. Like, it's just not. Like, I'm not that guy. Some guys get better as the game goes on. I wasn't that guy, but they never, like, they didn't see that. But I was not going to complain. I was just going to go out and keep trying to, you know, get better and better.
And that's back when starters were getting asked to turn over the lineup 3 times. Whereas if this had happened to you, say, this year, maybe it's like, hey, you got to give us, if you give us 5 innings, that's great. Congratulations. Dude, go take your shower.
Yes, I would probably have had an ERA of 2 runs lower than what it was. I would have had more wins than 4. I would have had less losses than 15. So that's just the day and age of baseball now. Like, you know, I had like 170, 169, or 170 innings that year. That's what a lot of the starters have nowadays, you know? And I didn't even start the last month of the season. I got put back in the bullpen in September. So, and I know why I got put back in the bullpen too, because I was about to hit an incentive where they would have had to pay me more money. So that's, you know, and I still led the team in complete games and innings pitched, but it was just an awful experience. You know, and I go back to the bullpen the next year and I make the All-Star team, but it still wasn't fun. Like, I felt like it was such a struggle to pitch after that.
Taking into account everything that was going on in your personal life, that season as a starter, I would imagine like the increased physical wear did not do you any good. Like, by the time you get to your early 30s and you're starting to bounce around a little bit, you're with the Mets, you know, you find yourself pitching for the famed Long Island Ducks. When you're, you know, I know you were still dealing with your own issues on, you know, on the personal front, but when you're towing the rubber in Long Island, are you still seeing like vestiges of the guy who was, you know, who was pitching in the 2000 All-Star game? And are you still like, is that still your goal of like, I'm going to get back to that? Or is it, I'm here because they're still paying me? Or like, kind of what's the mindset when you've already accomplished every, you know, all these things you had accomplished in baseball and like still trying to pitch through indie ball?
So I think the mindset was, I'm a baseball player and I don't want to be done yet. You know, that's kind of obviously wanted to get back to the big leagues, but looking back, I should have done a lot more to try to get back to the big leagues. I was just happy that I still had somewhere to play, you know, regardless of what the Long Island Ducks were paying or whoever was paying. Like, I just was still a professional baseball player. And that's kind of what my identity was in my eyes. Like, I was nothing else but a baseball player. And what happens if I don't play anymore? If I say no to Long Island Ducks, then I'm not going to play. Then what am I? Who am I? You know? So that's why I kept trying to play. I think knowing in the back of my mind, I had no chance to get in the big leagues, no chance getting back, because I was barely throwing, you know, 88 miles an hour. Nobody wants a 30-year-old that throws 88 miles an hour with sink, you know, like, especially at the back end of the bullpen. They're not going to look for that. And ever since that year that I started, my velocity went way down and I can never get it back. And so it's just like, I'm going to hang on as long as somebody wants to say, yeah, we'll give you an opportunity. And then finally in 2009, I'm like, I went to the Houston for spring training and had a great time, great guys there. And I'm like, this, I don't want to do this anymore. This is not fun for me. You know, I don't need to be a baseball player. So I left.
How long did it take you post throwing that last pitch to find, to like, find that new identity or like craft that new identity? Like, I'm not a baseball player anymore. This is who I am. Like, how long did it take you to be comfortable in retirement? Because like, based on, I've had over 100 conversations on the show. I have friends who've done that. Like, that's one of the most, even me as like a mediocre D2 baseball player, was a very weird feeling of I'm no longer this thing that I have centered my entire identity around. And like, you doing that into your 30s, like that's a whole different animal.
Yeah. So I took a couple years away from the game, like completely, you know, no TV, no reporting, none, no announcing, none of that. Like I was just a dad at home, and I got remarried, thankfully, to a wonderful lady here in San Antonio. So it's like that helped the transition, but I wanted nothing to do with baseball. So for a couple years, it's just like, I'm just going to be a dad and hang out, you know, drive the kids around. And then all of a sudden I get this opportunity to get back into the game on the media side. And that's when I knew, like, okay, now I can be a former player and be okay with it, because now I'm still in the game, but not as a player. I get to talk about it, which is a lot easier than actually playing it. So, that probably just a couple of years till I realized I'm a former player, and then I'm fine with it.
You also went back and got your degree. A lot of guys, yeah. a lot of guys don't. What made you decide to go wrap that up?
So it started off as a joke. So Gino Damari, who was my teammate at Miami, he was a senior when I was a freshman. When he got the job at Miami, took over for Coach Morris, I called him, congratulate him. And I said, hey, I'm thinking about going back to school. You got any connections with the finance department? Like, totally joking around. He's like, yeah, we'll pay for every bit of it if you want to do it. I'm like, seriously, dude, I'm just kidding. He's like, no, I'm not. If you want to come, tell me, we'll get you set up and we'll pay for it all. So I'm like, and I don't want to move to Miami. I have a family here. You can do it online, dude, just do it online and get your degree. And I'm like, seriously? And then the rest is history, man. And I'm like, this is great.
Not to compare them, but what was a more proud day, that diploma or the Reds Hall of Fame?
You know, the diploma was a pretty big deal to me. I think just because my mom always wanted me to have a degree, and she kept saying, you need to go back. And I'm like, why? I have a good job. I'm still in baseball. I don't need a degree anymore. She's like, just to say you have it. So I think that was, to me, was a bigger deal. Just to make my mom proud of something that I accomplished.
If you could go back and give a speech to yourself the day you got drafted, or maybe the day you signed, because the speech the day you signed might be different the day you got drafted, considering you tore your ACL right after. If you could give a speech to that guy, what would that speech look like?
You know, I've been asked this before, and I don't really know how to answer it, because as much of my career that was great, and then there was a lot of bad parts of my career, I'm thankful that I went through that, because now as a 52-year-old, I'm in a much better place because of those failures that I had, you know, and because of the issues that I had with mental health and the physical issues. I think if things would have been great the whole time, I never would have grown, you know, as a person. I think if I was the same when I was a player, and I was very accessible to the media as a player, but I also wanted my privacy. So if I was that same guy, I wouldn't have been fortunate enough to do this with you. I would have said no, you know, or even the podcast with Darren, I would have just been like, I'm done with that stuff. But I think all that stuff made me realize that, you know, I need to be a better human being, obviously, and just, you know, be kind to people.
Yeah, that's a valuable perspective. No, I like that. I got a quick rapid fire for you, and then I'll let you get out of here.
Okay.
Favorite ACC ballpark that is not Miami?
Oh, gosh. I like Clemson. I didn't like playing there as a player, because even independent, we played there one year, and I hated it. But I love it now. The atmosphere there and the Cajun Grill down there in right field, it's pretty legit.
I, I would imagine the food is delightful. Yeah. Favorite big league ballpark?
Dodger Stadium, for many reasons. I don't know what it's like now. I haven't been there in a while, but they had the best playing surface. Like, the grass was unbelievable. I would show up early just to go and lay on the grass for a while. It was like perfectly cut, and they had the best showers in the league, best water pressure.
How about that? That's a, yeah, that's a nice little tidbit. Who had the best bullpen, like best bullpen setup?
Houston, right there under the Crawford boxes. Yeah. It was great because if you could still see the game, if you wanted to go behind the scoreboard, you can go behind the scoreboard and watch the game, you know, the little manual scoreboard, but nobody can bother you. And if you throw a ball, even 50 miles an hour, it echoes in there. So it just makes you feel like you're throwing 120 every time you throw a ball.
Gives you that confidence. Best hitter you ever faced?
Albert Pujols.
Oof. That's like, you, right when he came up, was just from the get go. Like, what's the strategy? Like, you're facing that guy. What's the move?
Just hope he hits it at somebody. and you know, like, a lot of it was, and you know, people have looked up the numbers because I tell them this all the time, and they're like, oh, he didn't do that great off of you. Well, because a lot of the outs were hard hit outs, like they were smoked balls right at people. But for him, like, it was, if I could throw a sinker down and in a perfect spot, like at that bottom of the corner of the strike zone, he'd ground out to third. If I missed by an inch or two up or out over the plate, smoking it at somebody. Like, he was just that good.
Zero margin of error with a guy like that.
Zero. Yeah.
We live in the same city. I often ask guys, like, what's their favorite food spot in their, you know, in their playing city. What's your favorite San Antonio food spot? I would love to know.
Oh gosh. Well, my wife cooks a lot, dude. And I'm pretty spoiled with that. Let's see. I do enjoy Whataburger.
Oh, I mean,
that's probably not what you were looking for though.
I mean, listen, you can't go wrong with it.
No. It's funny, 'cause coming to Houston every year, that was something we always did, go straight to Whataburger. Now that I live here, there's one right across the street and I rarely go.
Yeah. It's like, it's gotta be a treat. 'Cause like, it's a heavy meal too. Like, you have Whataburger every, like, once a week, you're packing it on a little bit.
Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah. You got to kind of space it out a little bit.
I've got a rec for you that I think is based on where you told me your child went to high school, is probably close to you. Tacos and Salsa, which is like on 1604.
Yep, I know exactly where that is.
That place bangs. That is so good.
Okay, so my wife, one of her friends told her the same thing. We might have to try it now.
Tacos and Salsa slaps. Like, it's really good. Last question everyone gets is, do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
Yeah, when I got called up from single A to double A, they told me I had to hurry up and be there the next night to go on a road trip. So I leave from Kinston, North Carolina, had to drive to Canton, Akron to make sure I got on the bus. Well, that trip was like 10 or 12 hours just from Kinston to Canton, Akron. So I get a speeding ticket because I'm trying to get there so fast. So I get there. I have to get on the bus. We leave in an hour to go on a 14-hour bus trip to Portland, Maine. Yeah. Awful. Ooh. And double up. Like, we got one bus. It wasn't two buses. I had to sit there with somebody 14 hours.
It's funny. As long as I've been doing the show, I will ask guys questions and they'll be like, got to think about that. I asked the nightmare bus ride story and everyone's like, yes, this one. That that's the worst. Like, everyone has it burned in their mind. Just the,
I can't get that out of my mind. I tell people that all the time too. Like, that's, just imagine bus rides back then. It's not the same anymore, guys.
No. Yeah. I mean, no phones, no iPad, like,
nothing, magazines.
Yeah. In the baseball butt, like, there's spitters everywhere and it's just, it's a rough place. But, Danny, that is all I've got for you. Thank you so much for joining from Phenom to the Farm.
I appreciate it, Kyle. Thanks for having me, man.
Of course. And that's it for today's episode with Danny Graves. Big thanks to Danny for stopping by and walking us through his career journey. If you enjoyed listening to Danny, check out his podcast with my buddy Darren Vaught, ACC Baseball, etc. And make sure you subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. We'll catch you in a month. Thanks for listening.